today I'm going to be saying a little bit more on statistics and then spending most of the class on a general review of what we've done. I don't know if I'll finish that today or not, but I would suggest that between now and next Monday, you should look over whatever your notes, the text, whatever, and figure out what you don't know. Because, you know, if necessary, I suppose I can spend Monday reteaching the semester, but I'm obviously not going to cover the semester, and it's a good deal more productive if I end up spending the time dealing with particular areas that one or another of you found problematical. All right, does that make sense? No way I can make you do it, but I think it is in your rational self-interest to do it, and as an economist, I believe in people doing stuff in their rational self-interest. Basically, what we've been doing in statistics did not actually involve doing any statistics. You weren't calculating regressions and means and stuff. But I did give you a couple of problems with very small numbers in order that you could try doing it just to see, sort of get your hands a little bit dirty with what it really was. And the ones that I gave you, you could do it by hand. Arithmetic, I assume people still learn arithmetic despite the fact that we have cheap calculators now. You could do it with a calculator. If you ever actually want to do slightly larger problems of this sort, if you're used to using spreadsheets, they're really very useful general tools for this sort of stuff. With a little bit of effort, you can set up a spreadsheet so it will calculate your standard deviation. It probably has a function for the standard deviation, but if it didn't, it would be pretty trivial to just set up, you know, a column of numbers, take them, add them up and divide by the number, that's the mean, take for each of them another column next to it, which is that number minus the mean, another column next to that, which is the square of that, another one at the bottom of that, the sum of that, divide that by the number, take the square root, and you're home free, you've got the standard deviation. So if you want to sort of play with numbers, that's a way of doing it. It doesn't involve learning any new. It's interesting. How many people here actually use Excel or use a spreadsheet? There you go. Excel. So probably most of you. I think of that as sort of one of the really brilliant ideas of my lifetime, the spreadsheet. That it's sort of this very, ultimately, conceptually very simple and yet extremely powerful tool. And those of you who are interested in intellectual property may think about the fact that the people who invented it did not, in fact, patent it, had no ownership over the idea at all, even though it was a very important idea. All right, so as I said, I gave you a couple of problems on the syllabus. Let's start by eyeballing a regression. And it occurred to me yesterday thinking about it that if we're doing that, it might be... It might be useful to consider the fact that this is a whiteboard. Unfortunately, I do not have a really big ruler. Is there anything lying around here that's a really big straight edge? I'm going to have to just do it freehand. But what we observe here, the problem is it's a little bit high. I may have to. What I wanted to do was to just draw a line, and you can see what the line would be like. It would be going through about here at about that sum. Alright? And if you actually run it as a regression, which I think I did 2 years ago, I didn't redo it this time. If you run it as a regression, what do you get? I don't think I've got the tools to do it on the screen. You get an R squared of 0.76. That is to say, it's close enough to straight line to that slope so that about 3/4 of the variation of the points can be explained by the dependence on the x value. The intercept is 1.72. Can you see my cursor on the screen? This is 1.72. Okay, what I really ought to do, if I do this again, I ought to have a second slide with the line through it. But you can see that the intercept is about here. If you drew the line, it would be about there. I bet there's some way of doing it in color. And the slope is about 0.56. That is to say, every time that x goes up by 1, y goes up by about a half. Right, can you see that eyeballing it? If you just try to look at... Yeah, as I said, I should also be taller. Or I should have this lower, because... Now I could do it like this. I could stretch this out.
you can see the main, what the basic line is going to look like. It's going to be like about that through those. Right? Now, if you were not doing the regression, you're just eyeballing it, looking at those points, what suspicion might occur to you? Not a certainty. Your data is way too small, so I may have actually created it using a random number generator. But what might occur to you looking at those things? What it sort of looks like? Yep.
And maybe there's a drop instead of a straight line.
Huh. I hadn't thought of that, but there might be. It could be a slight curve. That's one possibility. Does it also look a little bit as though maybe there are two different groups? The top three are pretty close to a straight line. The bottom two, same slope. So maybe there's a missing variable, and the top three are male, and the bottom two are female, or something. Some binary variable that's separating them. But that's just a guess. I don't know. The point there is only that the regression doesn't tell you everything. Regression. Your eyes, in some ways, are better than regression. But anyway, that's what happens if you... I think what I asked you to do was not to actually calculate the regression, but just to draw the line. But for those of you who drew the line, do you remember if you actually got about that intercept and about that slope? That's really all we should. All right. What's the correlation coefficient? Well, for these numbers, here's the set of numbers as numbers that are on that graph. The mean of x is 3. Also, the median, as it happens, x is just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The mean of y is about 3.4. Adding up those numbers, dividing by 5. Therefore, the values of x's deviation from its mean are minus 2, minus 1, 0, plus 1, plus 2. Of y's, they're the numbers there. So if you wanted to calculate a correlation coefficient, you take x minus x mean times y minus y mean, add them up for all of them, divide by the number to average, and that gives you a value. And similarly for these things, you end up with an r of 0.87. Yeah.
Well, we need to calculate a correlation.
I doubt it.
Coefficient on these
things. I doubt it. But I think it's good for your soul to have done it at least once. Just in terms of, I mean, I'm a little worried about the pattern, which I think occurs too often, where people know words and not ideas. And that one way of sort of trying to keep yourself from doing that is to say, all right, I've done all this talk about physics. Can I calculate the behavior of billiard balls? Feynman, famous physicist, there are a couple of volumes, autobiographical volumes, which are sort of told by him to whoever actually wrote them, and he tells about visiting some university in South America where the physics graduate students didn't know any physics. They could talk about physics, but they couldn't do any physics problems because they were sort of seeing it from sort of a scholastic view in which actually doing stuff is sort of lower class, and, you know, speaking philosophically about stuff is upper class. That sort of struck me as something one ought to always worry about. Somewhere I came across the only bit of profound Eastern wisdom that I've ever seen actually struck me as profound. And that was somebody who said, the purpose of a fish trap is to catch fish. Once you have the fish, you no longer need the trap. The purpose of a rabbit trap, or what it was, a snare, is to catch rabbits. Once you have the rabbits. The purpose of words is to catch ideas. Once you have the ideas, you don't need. Where can I find a man who has forgotten words so I can talk with him? And it seems to me that the underlying point of the difference between seeing any set of ideas as the words describing them and as the ideas themselves was really important. So anyway, so that's why I think it is useful, and you know, you can use small numbers as in this case, so it's not much work, but just to see what you're doing with the names. Second problem. Friend visiting SVU comments on how young all you people look, right? Barely out of kindergarten. And conjectures that their average age is only 24. You disagree. And inside, before you looked at any numbers at all, what would you be able to say from general knowledge about the average age of law students attending their university? What do you already know about it because of your knowledge of the world? What is your prior, as it were? Right? Because we all have priors for all sorts of things. Is it at all plausible that the average age is 21?
No.
It can't be. Why can't it be?
College.
Because almost everybody is at least 22 when he graduates from college.
Now, if it was a single person, that wouldn't be true. As I may have commented, I got interviewed a couple of years ago by an undergraduate here who turned out to be 14. But that's very, very unusual. So you can say almost certainly everybody here is at least 22. It's a three-year program for the full-time people, so therefore it's almost impossible for the average age to be less than 23. All right, 22, 23, 24 would give you 23. But in fact, you know first that some of them are part-time people spreading it out over a longer period of time. You know that, especially among the part-time, many of them are people who did something else and then went back to law school, so therefore your initial response should probably be, 24 is a pretty low estimate. I wouldn't be surprised if that's wrong, even though you don't really have the data. Now, if you were being really elaborate, you would say, well, wait a minute, actually it could be less than 23 if the law school flunked out a lot of people. If there were many more first year than second year, but you probably know that isn't the case. You know, there's some attrition in the class, but not very many. The story used to be about Harvard, that sort of the first lecture at Harvard Law School, person giving a lecture tells the students, look right, look left. One of the three of you isn't going to graduate. But not true now, I suspect, being at Harvard over here. All right, so you ask four students in one of your classes how old they are and use the information to analyze the answers. Obviously, the sample size is tiny. What other problems are there before we get to answering the question? What else is wrong with this procedure aside from the fact that we only spoke before? Just list the things, potentially, the ways in which this might give you the wrong answer, so to speak.
The other ways, other than sample size. Very good. The class is a non-random sample because evening classes almost certainly have older students in the day classes. So either one is going to be wrong. It's just going to be wrong in different directions according to what you did. So let me list that briefly. Non-random sample. And of course, if you wanted to persuade the other person, you might deliberately do it in an evening class in order. Yep.
You might be in a class that is only taken by upper.
That's right, even. Absolutely. That is to say, indeed, you almost certainly are in a class which is non-random for that reason, because it's either a first-year class or it isn't. Right. So that's going to be non-random sample twice. All right, putting that aside, what problems still remain? Do people always tell the truth about their age? All right, I think the traditional belief is that women lie about their age down and men up. You know, there's this old joke about the woman who says, you know, I've decided not to be married until I'm 25, and her sister says, I've decided not to be 25 until I'm married. And I don't know if that's so true in the modern world, but there were reasons why it was true in the past. But I also wouldn't be astonished. Probably in this context, almost everybody tells the truth. You can certainly imagine contexts where, for one reason or another, people wouldn't. It also might be the case, and again, it probably isn't true here, but it might be that the people willing to answer such a question would be a non-random selection. That somebody, I don't know, maybe not for this question, but certainly think of cases where some people would regard it as an intrusive question, and some people wouldn't, and that would affect your thought. So that's not only a non-random sample, but non-random for the people answering. All right, those are probably enough for the moment. So now, what's the mean age of the sample? The mean age of the sample, if you add those numbers up, 24 plus 26 is 50, 74, 104, divided by 4, and you get 26, roughly. Is that right? That's right. Yeah, so 26 is the mean age, and that's higher than 24 already, so that's a bit of evidence. But how good is the evidence? Well, the standard deviation of the population, we estimate from the standard deviation of the sample, except that we divide by n minus 1 instead of n. And you ought to all remember in an intuitive sense why you have to do something like that, although that's by no means a rigorous proof. That the problem is that the sample will seem to be tighter than the distribution is because the mean will be off in the same direction that the elements of the sample are off.
So we just calculate the standard deviation, and I hope you actually did the numbers. It's not rocket science. And you end up with the standard deviation of the population being estimated at 8. Sorry, the squared standard deviation. Okay, square root of the sum of squares. So that gives you 2.8. With 4 observations, you reduce the standard deviation of the mean of the sample, goes down by the square root of the number in the sample, which is 2. So therefore, your standard deviation here is 1.4. And we then have 26 minus 24. That's the difference between the hypothetical mean of the population, which your friend said 24, and your observed one, which is 2. Divide that by the standard deviation of what you did, your mean, and you get a Z of about 1.4. All right? People all follow that? I hope you actually did, because I think it's useful to have done it once just to make sure you know what you're doing. And I should say, I don't know if this will be on the exam, but I could imagine having a problem like this, probably without the arithmetic, but with the rest of it done. You're welcome to bring calculators, by the way. I don't think you'll need them. And I assume if you're doing the exam on a computer that the software locks you out so you couldn't use a spreadsheet. It strikes me as unfortunate. Anyway, so that tells you of a Z of 1.4. Is this a one-tailed or a two-tailed test? Anybody?
A single-tailed test.
Single-tailed test, because your claim is not 24, but it's more than 24. So you wouldn't have counted. If it had come out 22, you would have said, well, it sounds like you may be wrong, but my claim is clearly wrong. I have stronger evidence against your claim than against the one you were testing. So it's one tailed, and you look it up on the Z tables. I hope you all did, just to have done that once, and that gives you a 0.08 probability of being that far off by chance. So you can say, pretty good reason to think that your statement was wrong, but that's all I can really say. I can only say that there's a little bit less than one chance in 10 that my little tiny sample would have been this far above your 24 if it wasn't true that people in Santa Clara lost 4 million on average. Everybody follow that much? All right. So now let's go to review of the semester. And the review of the semester, we started out with decision theory. Then we did game theory, and for some odd reason, the text stuck its discussion of insurance in with the game theory. And then we did contracting, then accounting, then finance. Then I added a day, I think, on back of the envelope calculations, which I hope you found fun. I find them fun. And, you know, you may have come into some sense. I don't know. Notice that we just did a back-of-the-envelope calculation when we were discussing how old law school students had to be. All right, it was back-of-the-envelope calculation when I averaged first, second, and third year. Initially, I didn't include any estimate of how those numbers changed, just that we know they're vaguely similar. We don't plunk out a large fraction of our students. And I started out with the simplest assumption to get the lowest possible number, which is that everybody goes into law school straight after college and does it in 3 years, and even that gets you a 23-year-old one. So that's a back-of-the-envelope calculation. Give you a lower bound, and you have some feeling that probably the real number is noticeably above that, but you don't know beyond it. Anyway, we then did what I would call price theory, what they probably call microeconomics. The sort of standard language is micro and macro. And I regard that as a very misleading way of putting it. It's one of these many cases where you can make people think they understand things by using a catching phrase without having to really understand them, because the world wheat market is a problem in microeconomics. So that I think the closer description is that what they call microeconomics is really price theory. It's really understanding how exchange via markets with prices works. And what they call macro is really disequilibrium theory. That in microeconomics, unemployment doesn't exist. Unless you have price control. But in ordinary market, unemployment doesn't exist, because if any resource is there in excess supply, the result is whoever owns that resource is willing to cut his price on it, and that as you cut the price, quantity demand goes up, quantity supply goes down until they're equal.
So a bunch of important issues, such as unemployment, really vanish in the nice, clean, neat theory that we call price theory, and you have a much less clear, less well understood area of economics in which we try to deal with disequilibrium, let's say, with markets that aren't clearing for one reason or another. Anyway, so we spent time on price theory. We then went on the economic analysis of law. And it's too late for any of you to take the full course on that unless you're part-time students, because I only teach it every other year and I taught it this year. If anybody's really interested, however, the textbook I teach it from, which I wrote, is on my webpage. The lectures, like these lectures, have almost all been recorded, and you can teach it for yourself if you find it as fascinating as I do, which, alas, you probably don't. But in any case, we tried to do a brief coverage of economic analysis of law, somewhat confused by the fact that since I was teaching the same course, I couldn't always keep track of what I had said to which class. We then went on to basic statistics and then to multivariate statistics, where multivariate, the way they distinguish it in the book, is multiple regressions and similar things where you've got... So let's try to do a brief summary of each of these, and please stop me at whatever point I'm talking about something that you think needs more explanation. So what's decision theory? It's a way of formalizing the making of decisions in order to help you make decisions better. That's the simplest way of describing it. And you do it with a diagram. You hopefully all still remember them if they haven't faded out into the distant past as mist. You have a diagram in which you make a choice, something happens, you make another choice, something happens, you make another choice, something happens, and so forth. Some choices have costs associated. If you decide to go to court, you're going to have to pay your lawyer some amount of money. At the end of the process, and there are of course many different ends according to what choices you've made and what's happened, because what's happened is sometimes some random variable, such as how the jury votes, or whether you discover that there is or isn't pollution on this property you've just bought. But something happens at each stage, and when you go through all of those switches, there at the end there is a number. And what is that number? The value to you of getting to that end. And you can say, all right, getting to this endpoint cost me how much? What are the costs? And they might be positive terms as well along the way. So on net, how do I evaluate that endpoint? And you just run it back. You say, well, the final result is I get $500. But to get that last step, I would have to pay $50. All right, so back here, it's only worth $450. And this one, nothing. But next one back cost me $100. So therefore, finally getting to there is worth $350, and you could run that through all of your endpoints, find the one you prefer, and that tells you where you want to go. All right. So that's the basic logic of it. And for simplicity, we usually think of it in terms of maximizing the expected value, that is the average payoff, because there are random switches in there where you've got to say the value of getting to here isn't actually the value of getting to there. It's 50% of there and 50% of there, because that's the odds of each of those happening. So when you run all through that, how do we average that out? The easy way is we just say 50% chance of $300 plus a 50% chance of $100, that's worth $200. And that's the right answer if you imagine that you're doing this many, many times, and therefore the results are going to average out. But it's the wrong answer. It's also the right answer probably for most of us if the sums are not large in terms of our wealth. Because if you're talking about changing your total wealth between $100,000 and $100,001, or even $101,000, probably the value to you of dollars isn't going to change very much over that range. But if you're thinking about options where one of the possible outcomes is you're completely wiped out and the other outcome is you have $5 million, probably that doesn't really average to $2.5 million, because from $2.5 million up, dollars are worth a lot less to you than they were for the first few thousand. All right? Make sense? So therefore, if in those circumstances you really have to think about risk aversion, and you or the customer you're working from, you have to be able to put it in terms of, as best you can tell, how do you feel about this gamble? You know, what would it take to make you take this gamble? Doing it formally, if you actually look at how you draw out that diagram, you would have to know all alternatives you face, all of the probabilities for the random events, all of the costs of doing things, and all of the payoffs at the end. And one way of looking at it is, well, I never know all this, so this is useless. But another way is, seeing what I would have to know to answer the question tells me what questions to ask, what information to try to get. And I can do the best I can to figure out all of these things. And at some point, I may say, well, this one is really hard to figure out, but here's a possible range. Does it matter? And it may turn out that the highest value payoff and the lowest value payoff, you still wouldn't do it because they're still worse than this, or that you still would do it. Then you don't have to need it. You don't need the detailed information. So it's really, again, a way of formalizing what you're doing and making decisions in order to make them better. Okay? Let me go back a moment. Any questions on decision theory before we move on to the hard stuff? No. All right. Game theory. Game theory is strategic behavior and turns out to be extraordinarily more difficult than decision theory, which is why we don't really do it. We just sort of put a toe in the water and try to see a little bit of it that hopefully will help us understand the world a little better. But in game theory, there are at least two people making choices. Each has his own objectives, and each of them will engage in strategic behavior in the sense of, if I do this, what will he do? What do I think he is doing? Can I make him do something different by threatening that I'll do something different? A whole bunch of complications that don't exist in ordinary decision theory. As I mentioned Monday, I ended up giving a talk as part of the sustainability project that SCU has been pushing yesterday and I guess still today. I should say, I thought it was to the credit of the school, that when I emailed them saying, look, everything you have on sustainability is in favor of it, that's propaganda, not education, the response was, give a talk. And I gave a talk. Almost nobody was there, but I recorded it. So if anyone is curious, it's up on my webpage now in the talks I gave. But it occurred to me in doing it that one of the many elements in people talking about global warming is forgetting that there's more than one person in the world. And what I mean is that people talk as if one option was getting China and India to drastically reduce their use of fossil fuels, and that's the sort of thing we should be doing if we want to prevent global warming. But there isn't anybody running the world. A good thing, too, I should say. But there isn't anybody running the world. China will do what the people running China want to do, India what they want to do. Both of those countries are very poor countries that are quite rapidly becoming less poor at this point. It would be much harder for them to do that if they had to use expensive sources of power instead of cheap sources of power. And the way I put it in the talk is that the developed world is rich, but it's not rich enough to bribe China and India into staying poor. And that therefore you should simply not think of it as if mankind was a single player. Right? I think that's the mistake in many, many discussions of a lot of different issues. To imagine that mankind is a single player and we have to figure out what he has to do. Mankind is 8 billion players, and you have to in some sense take account of the fact that each of them has his own objectives. And that it's going to be very hard to persuade people in China that they should go hungry in order that people in Bangladesh won't get flooded, for example. So anyway, so there are a number of different questions we'd like to ask in game theory. I should say, if you think of the subject, game theory really is relevant to understanding international politics, economics, literal games in the normal sense, marriage, life, business. It's hard to think of many things that humans are engaged in that don't have a sizable element of strategic behavior in them, namely all the things that involve more than one human. One human, you don't have strategic behavior, and that's about it. So one question you would like game theory to answer, if it could, is, given that I'm in a game, what ought I to do? How do I play to best achieve my objectives? A different question you might ask is, I am observing these people interacting. They're in a game. What's going to happen? And those aren't necessarily the same question, but the same tools are going to be useful trying to answer both. So one perspective is somebody who is a player in a game, and the other someone who's analyzing the results of games, and one reason might be that you're creating games. So every legislator is creating a game. That is to say, he's setting up a set of rules, and he'd better think about how people will respond to those rules, and some of those responses might be strategic. All right? give one example again from the sustainability thing, and that is that, as you may know, Al Gore, I think to his great credit, conceded at some point in the last year or two that biofuels had been a mistake. This was a project which he had supported, large subsidies for turning corn into alcohol and burning it as a substitute for gasoline. One reason he thought it was a mistake was that he had concluded it didn't actually do much to keep down carbon dioxide production, for complicated reasons I'm not expert in. But he also conceded that the one thing it did do was to promote world hunger by reducing the amount of food out there by diverting crops. But the interesting point, he said two other interesting things there. One of them was that, looking back at it, part of the reason he had been so much in favor of it was that he comes from an agricultural state, Tennessee, and he was planning to run for president and therefore had a tender view of the farmers of Iowa, where there's an early important primary. So that in effect what he was conceding, and again I think this is to his credit, was that sort of with one hand he was an environmentalist, with one hand he was a politician, and one of them is door to the other. But the other point he made was that once you get something like this, it's very hard to stop it because of the lobbies. And of course, if you think about it, if you're sort of imagining it as an abstract intellectual, we say, well, you know, this was a mistake, but now Gore has figured it out, and presumably other environmentalists figure it out, we'll stop doing it. But we won't stop doing it. Why won't we stop doing it? Because making food prices high is not a loss. It's a win from the standpoint of the agricultural lobbies, from the standpoint of farmers. And consequently, there is a whole lot of political pressure which helped get biofuels in the first place, but which is also going to keep biofuels. Maybe I'm wrong, but you know, the Republican Party is a lot less enthusiastic about environmentalism than the Democratic Party. But I will be very pleasantly surprised if the Republican majority in Congress kills biofuels, because they are just as enthusiastic about getting the votes of farmers as the Democrats are. So that's again a case where, if you're sort of imagining the problem you're facing is figuring out what mankind should do, you're going to get the wrong answer, because you could say, well, let's just try this experiment, but once the experiment is in, there are then interest groups that are going to keep it in even if it's a failure. So anyway, general point. So making a law, but also if you're drawing up a contract, which is unlike making a law, is something that many of you are going to end up doing. A contract is a little miniature legal system for the parties. It says what the rules are between them. And you want to say, how will each of them act? Try to use game theory to say, what are the opportunities that each one has to benefit itself, possibly at the expense of the other? If some of these opportunities are things which on net make the two worse off, maybe we should change the contract we're drawing to eliminate that. And that's what our contract discussion largely is. And similarly, if you're running a firm, if you're running a small law firm, you'd like to think about how the people in that firm are going to act, given that each of them is really engaged in strategic game with all the rest of them. So I think it's a useful way of thinking about stuff. It's just that it's also very hard to do it rigorously. And we looked at different ways of representing a game. That for a sequential tree game, you can use the decision tree, which is the same thing we did in decision theory, except that now we've got, you know, blue boxes and red boxes or something representing choices by player one and choices by player two. Alternatively, you can cover and describe any game at all by a strategy matrix. With two players, you say, here are all the strategies player one might choose, here are all the strategies player two might choose. If player one chooses this strategy and player two chooses this one, look at the intersection cell, and that will tell you what will happen. That would be a way you could imagine representing all games, where a strategy is a complete description of what you will do at every point in the game you might find yourself in. All right. So if you think about chess, that line of columns is surely going to have more columns in it than there are atoms in the earth, because the number of possible chess strategies is just enormously large. But if all you're doing is sort of mathematical analysis of the thing, not actually trying to solve it, you don't worry about how many columns you are. You're just saying, what's the logic of this problem? And you can learn useful things. So you want to represent a game, and you want some definition of a solution, and again, it's a little unclear what a solution means, given the inherent ambiguity of strategic behavior. One possible solution is subgame perfect equilibrium. That's the one that looks like decision theory. That's the one where you know that the other person will always do what's in his interest at the end, and you can just work back and figure out everything. Another one is dominance. That's the one where you say, whatever I do, it'll pay him to do that. Whatever he does, it pays me to do that. That answers it. Now we know what's going to happen. Then there's the von Neumann solution, which I tried to explain a little because it's in a sense the most successful project, even though it only gets as far as two-player fixed sum games. And then there's Nash equilibrium, which is a useful way of thinking about many-player games, basically.
Yep.
The von Neumann solution, I think, actually, yes, I'm going to get to it. Ask me the question a couple of slides down, because I have a brief description. So subgame perfect equilibrium is decision theory without commitment strategies. So it assumes that when Anne gets to her final choice, she always makes the decision that's best for her. Bill knows that, so he can make his previous choice, taking her choice for granted. By the way, the reason for Anne and Bill is, first, they're A and B, which makes it easy, and second, they happen to be the name of my wife's parents. And so it occurred to me to do it that way. And then you can just work back along that mechanism. However, the one problem with subgame perfect equilibrium is the problem of commitment strategies, that there might be ways in which Anne can tie her hands, set things up so that if Bill makes the choice she doesn't like, that she will somehow have to make a choice that's not the best one for her at that point, but Bill, knowing that, won't make the choice that she doesn't like because the one that hurts her hurts him too. All right, that's the basic logic of it, and the example we discuss, which is one I'm fond of because it's a simple one that lots of us are familiar with, is I will too throw a temper tantrum. That's the kid in whose interest, in a short run sense, it is to go quietly to bed because the temper tantrum does no good, but the kid, the parent planning to put the kid to bed, can read the kid's mind, so to speak, after many previous encounters, and realizes that it's not going to be that simple.
Alright.
So, for cases where commitment matters, consider one of the very most common games that we all get into, which is bilateral monopoly, where we both benefit if a transaction goes through, but according to what the terms are, we divide the benefit differently. So the sort of standard economist example is the apple, where I have the world's only apple, you are the only person in the world who isn't allergic to apples, what price do I sell it to you for? So each of us is using the threat of bargaining breakdown to try to shift the terms, which is fine as long as the threat doesn't actually happen. And that would describe union management bargaining. It would describe a lot of diplomacy. It would describe interactions between parents and children. It would describe what happens when you're buying a house. And one way of trying to get better terms is by commitment, by somehow turning some switch in your head, as it were, such that you will and can persuade the other person that you will turn it down if he doesn't offer you a good enough term. And there's a lot of that in human beings. I mean, I think there are reasons why we've got those switches in our head, in effect, and that there are lots of people who will, in fact, turn down a deal which they think is unfair to them, even though the deal is better than nothing, and that they've somehow tied their self-esteem, their feeling of worth, to getting a reasonable deal. And if you can succeed in doing it, you know, more power to you. It gets you better deals. The alternative is by misleading the other party about what terms is in your interest to accept. So that, for example, the house we now live in is more than 100 years old, and my wife and I like old houses, and they're very rare in this area. It's got a beautiful yard, which at this point is full of fruit trees, most of which I planted. And we got it for about the same price as other houses of the same square footage in the area. And we're reasonably well off. And if the sellers had had a really accurate view of our position, they would, I think, have held out for at least $50,000 more, maybe $100,000 more. This was about, what is it now, about 14 years ago, 15 years ago, prices were pretty high at the time. But they didn't, fortunately. And fortunately for us, apparently there aren't a lot of people in the housing market who have houses, and therefore we were able to get it. Now, of course, I will never know what the lowest price the sellers would have accepted. Maybe we could have gotten it for $100,000 less if we'd held out long enough. But that was a case where we couldn't conceal the fact that we liked the house. It was sort of obvious. But we could conceal how much we liked it. We couldn't talk about, we could choose not to talk about what our assets were and so forth. So that's the second. And the risk in each case is bargaining breakdown. The other risk, which I don't mention here but probably should, is expenditures on trying to push it. So that if you want to break down, if you think about a strike, for example, a strike is costly to both parties, but the strike from both sides, the union by refusing to accept the management's offer and the management by refusing to sweeten the offer, each of them is trying to persuade the other, this is the best you're going to get, and therefore you have to put up with it. So it's both breakdown in the literal sense and in the sort of continuous sense of higher and higher costs of the bargaining. Strategy matrix I mentioned before. Each strategy is a full description. In von Neumann's view of it, your strategy can include deliberately random elements, that if you're playing paper, scissors, stone, any predictable strategy is a bad one in a sense, because then the other party will play the thing that trumps it. But it turns out that you can guarantee an average payoff of zero, which is the best you can guarantee, by rolling a die each time, and one or two is one of them, three or four, five or six. So the matrix shows all strategies and the outcome for each pair, the average outcome, because there are random elements in it. And von Neumann showed that for a two-person fixed sum game, seen in this way, there was always a solution, what's called a mini-max or a saddle point for various reasons, which means a pair of strategies, each of which is the best possible strategy against the other, and at least that good against anything else. So if I play my von Neumann strategy, I know that on average I will get at least $10 out of the game. That's the value of the strategy. I know it, maybe I could get more if the other guy isn't playing his strategy. That's stealing candy from babies, as bridge player slang. But I know that whatever he does, I will get at least $10, and there is nothing I can do which would guarantee me more than $10, because if he plays his strategy, he can hold me down to $10. So that's the von Neumann solution. And a simpler kind of solution, but that often doesn't exist, is a pair of dominant strategies. And that's the case where I don't care what you're doing. You care what you're doing, it doesn't affect my payoff, but it doesn't affect what I do. I should confess whether you're going to confess or not, because I'm better off either way. That's the prisoner's dilemma story we all know. Does that answer your questions? Do you have more questions?
Yeah.
All right. Nash equilibrium in a many-player game, which, as I probably told you, is called Nash equilibrium because a guy called Cournot invented it. But Nash generalized the idea. Cournot was really doing a two-player version of Nash equilibrium, and Nash generalized it and proved mathematical theorems about it and stuff like that. And I gather went crazy and got to have a movie made about it. And the Nash equilibrium is describing a set of strategies, one for each player. They might all be doing the same thing, they might not. That depends on the particular Nash equilibrium. But where each of them is making the right decision given what the rest are doing. So that given what all of you are doing, there's no strategy I could follow which would be better for me than the one I'm following. And the same statement is true for all. So one example is everybody driving on the right. That's a Nash equilibrium. But of course, everyone driving on the left is a Nash equilibrium too. But everybody but me driving on the right is not a Nash equilibrium. I would greatly improve my prospects for survival if I switched to driving on the right too. And then my other example is the prisoners who are breaking out of death row, and the guard has one bullet in his gun and says, first guy across that line dies, and they all go back to their cells. And that's a Nash equilibrium, because given that the others are going back to their cells, I'd better not be the one guy who tries to cross that line. And these examples suggest that there is no reason to expect the Nash equilibrium either to be unique or to be optimal for the players. So that Sweden driving on the left was an equilibrium, even though it was probably not optimal, and changing that required everybody acting together. And both right and left are equilibria, so it doesn't have to be unique. Yes?
That doesn't take account of collaboration, right?
That's right. That's correct. That's correct. Given what you are doing, and that includes the potential collaborator, and holding fixed everybody else and just changing me. So, one problem, I don't think I list here, I probably should list your case, that one of the problems with Nash equilibrium is that it might be unstable against two people acting together. You could easily enough imagine a case where if each of us acts separately, it's an equilibrium, but you and I can somehow make a deal that we'll both rush the guard. 50% chance of dying is better than a 90% chance of getting executed eventually. I'm assuming... Yeah, that's not collaboration. That's just expanding the strategy set, the set of alternatives, right? If I can shove you... What? Oh, yeah, right. That's true. That would be another possibility. Yes. And furthermore, as I was saying, the case which is more complicated but sort of interesting, which is the oligopoly case, it's not exactly clear what it means to say you will keep doing the same thing while I change what I do, because in some games, when I change what I do, it becomes impossible for all of you to keep doing the same thing. So if we're a bunch of firms in an industry and I decide to produce more, you don't have the option of continuing to sell the same number of units at the same price as you were before, because my extra production is going to drive down prices and people won't buy that number of units from you. All right. So in that case, it turns out that's an interesting case, because one definition of a strategy is that the other firm's strategy is how much they produce. And when I increase my output, they keep the same production and just let the price go to wherever it goes. A different definition of strategy is sell all we can at a certain price. And it turns out that those two give quite different predictions for what the Nash equilibrium of that particular game is. Then it went on to discuss insurance, which is interesting and important, but doesn't belong in the chapter because it's not any more game theory than lots of other things are. And moral hazard, which is really an example of what we later discuss under externalities when we're talking about economics and law and econ. Moral hazard is that because I have insured my factory for 80% of its value, the benefit to me of precautions to keep it from burning down is only 20% of the real benefit. So if I spend money, or if I fire a guy who's a good worker but smokes, and I'm a little worried he might start a fire, but I don't want to fire him because he's really good, I bear all of the cost of doing that, and 4/5 of the benefit of reducing the risk of fire goes to the insurance company. So that implies that I will be less willing to do expensive things that prevent fires than in some sense I ought to be. That I will not take a $50 precaution with a $100 payoff because the payoff to me is only $20. That's moral hazard. And I guess the special thing about the particular kind of externality we have in insurance is that it's voluntarily adopted. I don't have to insure, after all. So when deciding whether to get insurance, I have to balance benefits and costs. One of the costs is that I will now not take certain precautions worth taking, and I ultimately pay for that because the insurance company knows that's going to happen and will price the insurance for the probability of a fire given that I won't take those precautions. Right. So what are the solutions? One solution is for the insurance company to include in the contract that I've got to take certain precautions. And another very partial solution is that instead of insuring for 90 or 100% of the value of the factory, I insure for 50%, which isn't as good protection in terms of risk aversion, but now means that all of the precautions whose payoff is at least twice their cost will get taken. And only the precautions whose payoff is a little bit more than their cost won't get taken. So that's a noticeably less of a loss to me than having the high levels. So that's what's called coinsurance. And one point I don't think I did, I don't think the book discusses, and I don't know if I discussed or not, though I do in another class, is that there are some cases where moral hazard is a feature rather than a bug. And those are the cases where the person you're transferring the risk to is more competent, more capable than you are to prevent the thing going wrong. So if you imagine, I guess my standard example is buying service contracts for something like a washing machine. And the economist's initial response is, huh, that makes no sense at all. You're insuring against a loss that's small compared to your income. Why would you bother to insure against it? And one answer is because Sears knows more about fixing their washing machines than I do. And therefore, they are better able to deal with the problem of the washing machine breaking down than I am, and so making it them who pays for it gets me a better result than if I pay for it. Now, it's not a perfect solution, because, of course, one thing that makes washing machines break down is people misusing them in one way or another, putting them in an unbalanced load or something, and I now have less incentive to do that because I got the service contract. But nonetheless, to some degree, shifting the incentive to them might be a benefit. And you could imagine similarly that if the company that insures factories against fire knows a whole lot more about what the risks of fire are than I do, that maybe transferring a good deal of the cost to them means that they will make rules for me that they'll impose on me that are better than the rules I make for myself. So it's a somewhat of an oversimplification to think of moral hazard as always being a cost. Sometimes it's really, sometimes the insurance is producing a benefit in addition to risk aversion, transfer of things. I should say, moral, I think, in this phrase is coming from an older usage which wasn't about right and wrong, but was about psychology. That it's related to our word morale, for example. So the point is that it's a hazard, which is a hazard not coming out of the facts of physical existence, but out of the rational behavior of human beings. So any questions on moral hazard? No. Adverse selection. There's this famous article, The Market for Lemons, which sort of explains, a guy called Akerlof explains adverse selection. And the basic problem is asymmetric information. The basic problem is that you've got a transaction and one of the parties has information the other one doesn't have. So if you imagine the Market for Lemons case, I know whether the used car I'm selling is a lemon or a cream puff. The buyer doesn't know and has no inexpensive way of finding out. So the buyer has to treat the car as sort of an average of the cars that are getting sold. That means that if it's really a cream puff, he's offering me quite a low price for it because he's allowing for the chance that it's a lemon. The lower the price he offers, the less willing I am to sell. I don't have to sell this car. I was thinking of getting a new car, but if I can't get a decent price for the old car, maybe I'll keep it. It's a cream puff. It never gave me any trouble at all. So that means that the cars that actually sell will not be the random selection of the cars offered to sale. They'll be the bottom part of that distribution, because the worse the car is, the more likely the seller is to accept the buyer's offer, given that the seller knows it's bad and the buyer doesn't. So you then end up, in the extreme case, that all of the lemons sell for lemon prices. People aren't getting cheated, but you can't sell a cream puff, because when you tell the guy he's a cream puff, he says, yeah, I've heard that story before. You have no way of proving it. What are solutions? One solution is the seller guarantees the car. He agrees to pay for repairs for the first year. That then creates some moral hazard problems, because now the buyer doesn't take as good care of it, but it does is one way of selling it. I think I told you my Ami Glazer story about buying a car, asking the seller if he'll provide a service warranty at a reasonable price, and if he will, you buy the car without the warranty, because you're just trying to use it to signal. But another possibility is to eliminate the asymmetric information by making sure that neither party has the information. It's hard to do that with the car, but if you're thinking about the case of genetic testing and insurance, one possible rule, probably not enforceable, but you could imagine, is to say we won't allow people to genetically test. Neither the insurance company nor the customer knows if the customer has genes that make him likely to die of cancer, and therefore everybody gets insured at a sort of an average price. As you may know, this is actually in a certain sense a live issue, that there have been firms offering kits by which you can inexpensively get your genes tested. Basically, you take a swab from your cheek or something, send it to them, and they send you information, which I gather can be quite useful information. It can tell you you've got genetic characteristics that make you noticeably more likely than most people to have this medical problem or less than that. And there has been some pressure, I think at this point, regulatory, not legislative, to prevent this from happening. And I think the pressure is coming not in the context of insurance, but in the context of the general tendency of the medical profession not to want to let people make their own decisions. To say, well, you know, people will do foolish things. If they think they know what they're doing, you should put it in our hands where the experts. And that's, I think, a pattern I've observed for a long time. But in any case, it is a likely, you know, in the near future to be a real legal issue whether people are free to get genetically tested. Very hard to prevent if they really want to, because they can always go off to Mexico or Canada or England or somewhere and get the testing somewhere outside of our legal system, but it's going to be an issue. So one problem, but in the general case, if you can keep anybody from knowing, that's one way of eliminating it. But the other way, which I thought I had here, but for some reason, maybe I thought I added it, maybe I didn't, the alternative is have both sides know. If we can make available car mechanics who can recognize a cream puff, the problem is solved. If the insurance companies are free to do genetic testing too, the adverse selection goes away. And the argument against that is that now you can still insure against getting cancer, but you can't insure against having genes that make you likely to get cancer. because you can't get people to bet on a die after it's been rolled. And in a world with good genetic testing information, whether you have genes that make you likely to get cancer is an observable fact and therefore uninsurable against. So, can we go back a moment? Any questions on moral hazard or adverse selection? Keep going. Contracting. We spent a good deal of time. To my mind, as a non-lawyer, this looked like one of the sections that could be really useful for the ordinary business of a lawyer, because it's a way of thinking about how to design a contract. And the basic approach here is, let's forget about all that bilateral monopoly stuff. Interesting though that may be, what we want to ask now is, how do we maximize the total thing? How do we maximize the total gains to the contracting parties from the contract, and then let them go off in another corner and fight over how they divide up those gains? And you maximize the total benefit from the least economist standpoint by getting the right incentives, by setting it up so that any choice which increases the total payoff is in the interest of the person who gets to make that choice to make it. All right, that's sort of a simple way of describing what you're trying to do. And part of that involves trying to eliminate moral hazard kinds of problems, trying to eliminate cases where I make a decision where I pay the cost and you get the benefit, and so therefore I won't make it unless the cost is close to zero, trying to eliminate situations where I pay all of the cost and you get half the benefit, and now I won't make it unless the benefit's at least twice the cost, and so forth. So you try to structure it. How do you do it? So far as possible, you make sure that each party bears the cost and receives the benefit, I should say, that depend on his actions. All right? Bear the net costs. And some of that might include decisions about what precautions to take against possible risks, deciding whether to breach and so forth. You also want to minimize adverse selection problems. You want to construct the contract in such a way that if signing the contract is in the interest of the parties, they will sign. Unlike the guy with the cream puff, where selling it at a high price would be in the interest of both him and the buyer, but he won't sell it. So part of that means set it up so that each party is bearing the costs that he knows. And that way each party knows the value to him of the contract, and if there is some price at which the value to both of the contract is positive, the contract will get signed. All right? So A knows the risk that a strike will halt his production, and B doesn't care, because A is the one who's going to have to pay for the cost if that happens. On the other hand, the ability to set up your contract in this way is going to be constrained by the fact that not all the relevant things are objectively observable. For example, the quality of materials or whose fault something going wrong was. So if you apply the idea, the first one was sort of a theorist's overview of the subject. We discuss how you arrange a production contract that is building a house, which is partly what are the terms of payment and partly what choices who gets to make. And the book goes into a good deal of, I think, interesting detail on that. And we then discuss a bunch of other kinds of contracts where all the same issues occur: service, principal agent, joint undertaking, sale or lease of property, loans, and so forth. And the issues that are common to many of these things include the allocation of risks, people's incentives, and what things are observable, because we can't have an arrangement that you have to pay for something happening if I don't know if it happened. If one of us decides to pull out of the contract, what are the obligations that creates? We want to make sure not that contracts are never pulled out of, but that they're only pulled out of when it's in the joint interest of the two parties that you pull out of it. And if there are conflicts, how do we deal with them? If something changes, how do we renegotiate? Those are all the sorts of issues. All right? So again, let me go back for a moment. Any questions about the contracting stuff? I hope your people will do better Monday. I want you to have lots of questions Monday so I don't have to think of more things to say. Alright, accounting. That's the one subject here that I learned most from when I first taught this course, because I didn't know anything about it. Learned some stuff from the contracting too. And accounting is a way of keeping track of what's happening in a firm or another organization And there's a real tension in how you do it. And the tension is between making it sufficiently rigid so that the people who are doing the accounting, who are never really neutral parties, or at least can't be trusted to be, can't easily control what shows up. So you want accounting rules where even though the accounting company knows that the CEO isn't going to ask them to do the accounting next year unless they produce the result he wants, they will have limited ability to produce the result he wants without violating the rules enough so they'll get in reputational trouble in the future, or legal trouble even. And yet at the same time, if it's too rigid, it generates no useful information because the real world is complicated and simple rules will never perfectly map to the real world. This is sort of like the issue, if you think about making laws, between bright line rules and, I guess it's standards is one term. The other term that's usually used in this discussion, but if you think about the question of who can run for president, all right, we usually think that being a native-born American is a bright-line rule, although some people think maybe it's not so bright a line. This time, have persuaded themselves that maybe the guy who won the last election wasn't. But being 35 at the moment is a bright-line rule. All right, it doesn't have to be. All right, if you imagine technological progress, let us suppose that at age 20 you came down with an incurable disease, but fortunately medical progress had gone far enough so we could do suspended animation. We can freeze you without injuring you. Cryonic suspension is called. So we freeze you, and 20 years later they come up with a cure from the disease. We thaw you. From your standpoint, no time at all has passed. We cure your disease, and you decide to run for president. Are you 40 or 20? Right? So in that world, it would be ambiguous that one of the things that happens with technological change is things that used to be clear rules become less clear rules. But at the moment, 35 is a bright line rule, but it's obviously the wrong rule. All right, all of us surely know or can imagine people who are more than 35 who are less mature than the average 35-year-old. It's not as if the actual age matters to being president. It's really what the age signals about you. And some of us may know or have known people who were less than 35 who are much more mature, much more grown up than the average 35-year-old. Some of us might even be able to imagine people who've gotten elected president who were less mature than the average 35-year-old. Like maybe, arguably, two of the last three presidents. Obama, I think, is in that respect a grown-up. I've got lots of reservations about Obama. But I think you can make plausible cases that Clinton and Bush were not grown-ups. Not sure. But in any case, whether that's the case or not, that's a case where if the rule was you must be as mature as the average 35-year-old, that would really translate as a majority of the Supreme Court has to like you or has to want you to be able to run for president, because there isn't an objective measure of that. So we use the bright line rule instead. Similarly, accounting is using bright line rules for similar reasons. What are some of the things you do? One of them is that since accounting involves adding up values of things like assets and liabilities, we need some way of defining the value of something, and it's got to be a way that doesn't depend on the accountant's judgment. So what's the usual rule? That the usual rule is the value of something is whatever you pay for. Various complications. Ordinary intangible assets, such as reputation, there is no good way of measuring it. You could always claim that your reputation was worth a fortune. And so we ignore them except when that intangible asset was actually bought, in which case, like a brand name, let's say, and then you've got a price for it. And similarly, it's hard to make objective statements of what's the probability. It's the probability that you'll lose this law case 20% or 30%, but you can come closer most of the time to saying it's either more or less likely than 50%. And so that's at least coming closer to saying your judgment is you'll probably win or you'll probably lose. So therefore, the rule is that all probabilities are treated as 1 or 0. And again, I'm oversimplifying, but only a little. And as I may have pointed out, that's also the rule in tort law. That in tort law, we don't say the odds that you are guilty are 37%, so you owe 37% of the damages, or 60%. 60% of the damages, we say by a preponderance of the evidence you are guilty, you owe all the damages. By a preponderance of the evidence you are innocent, you owe none of them. That's, again, roughly speaking, a plus or minus 50% rule. For similar reasons, because otherwise you have fairly hard decision problems. What does accounting involve? It involves balance sheets. A balance sheet is essentially a photo of the financial circumstances of a firm at one instant. an income statement, which is showing what's happened over time, and a cash flow statement, which is showing what's happened to cash over time. And the cash flow statement, again, is in one sense less informative because there are lots of assets other than cash, but cash is in some sense the least ambiguous asset. You know, a dollar is worth a dollar is worth a dollar, and if you claim that your bank account has $1 million and it doesn't, you're lying, and you can eventually get into serious legal problems. Whereas if you claim this piece of land is worth $1 million and it's only worth $100,000, you're not lying. You just have an optimistic view of the land market. So all of those are useful. And how do you do it? The sort of fun rubber meets of the road level of doing it is T accounts, in which each transaction is getting recorded. And each transaction in double entry bookkeeping, which was an invention of, I think, what, the late Renaissance, maybe somewhere around, maybe a little earlier than that, but like 400 or 500 years ago, I think, is that each transaction is shown in two places. That if you buy something, cash goes down and assets increase. If you sell something, it goes the other way around. If they don't balance, then the difference is eventually going to go to firm equity. And there are ways, rules for allocating stuff, such that on paper everything always balances. And all of this comes out of the matching principle, which is a statement about the relationship between assets, liabilities, and equity. And not the matching principle, sorry, the fundamental equation. Matching principle is the next thing now. The matching principle has to do with the question, in order to make sense of what's happening, we don't want to say you're obviously doing very badly because you spent a whole lot of money on something and look, we have no return, if what's really going on is you spent a whole lot of money on something which you expect to give you a return next year. And similarly, the other way around, if you got your return this year, but we're going to have to pay for it next year. So if you... Yeah.
Sorry, would you restate the match principle?
Yeah, I haven't gotten to the principle. What I was raising was the problem. The problem is we'd like to have ways, in order to evaluate things, we'd like to have ways of pairing up costs and associated benefits. And the matching principle basically says that we try to put in a given in one period both the costs and the benefits that match. So if I have the costs of producing and selling stuff, but I haven't been paid yet, we then call the payment I'm going to get accounts receivable, and we thus can see it matched up against the costs, against the loss of inventory, say, in that case. And so you try to move stuff forward or back in time by various accounting devices in ways designed to let the accounts for each year show what really happened, even if some of it is for things we're going to get later. So that's one issue. Another issue is defining an entity. This is one I'm always very aware of around the middle of April, because one of the things that I decided to do a long time ago, I've never been sure if it's worth the trouble, was to file a Schedule C to consider myself to be not only a professor, but also somebody with a small business which produces lectures and books and articles and things. And the beauty of this is that as long as I have a respectful amount of income from those activities, the IRS may not be too skeptical when I say that my computer at home is a business expense or something else is a business expense. All right? But a sufficiently skeptical IRS person might be able to make a plausible case that some of my business expenses are really consumption expenditures, and that's going to be true for lots of other people. That so if you want to get the accounting right, which of course I don't necessarily want to do, I want to do the accounting in whatever way gives me the lowest taxes, subject to my not being at serious risk of getting in trouble with the IRS. But if you wanted to do it right and find things out, you have to know where to draw the lines around your entity. Does the room which my home computer is in count as inside my business of writing and speaking? Well, certainly it's used for writing books, among other things. Or does it count as inside my private household, and so forth? So that issue. And there are lots of other contexts. If you think about any situation where you have an organization made up of several sub-organizations. So if you think about General Motors with its different divisions, or if you think about Santa Clara University with the law school and the business school and the undergraduate college, you would like, for lots of purposes, to be able to separately do calculations for the separate parts. So if you're the CEO of GM, you'd like to know whether the Chevrolet division is doing well. And accounting, you have to figure out a way of drawing a line around the Chevrolet division, deciding what costs incurred by GM are really their costs, and thus figure out what's happening. All right? And then using all this information, there are various questions you'd like to ask. Is a firm actually solvent? Not, I better not lend the money. How well is it doing? Should I buy stock? What were its real profits, since that's relevant to the taxes, and why? I don't know if any of you have ever read any Emma Latham books, but they're good, entertainment fiction. They're not great literature. They aren't profound ideas, but they're quite entertaining. They're not coming out anymore. This is actually two women, I think a lawyer and an economist, who co-authored under the title Emma Latham, a bunch of books whose protagonist is the, I think, senior vice president of one of the world's great banks. And the president of the bank is a upper-class incompetent who the vice president has got to sort of keep from messing things up too much. And each of the stories, somehow this vice president ends up being a detective in some kind of a mystery. And one of them, Accounting for Murder, is one which starts with a stockholders committee which is writing to a company saying, we think you're doing very badly, we want to investigate, and the company tries to brush it off, and somebody from the stockholder committee comes to talk to them about their accounts, and they try to brush them off, and then somebody realizes that this is the author of the standard book in accounting, is sort of one of the best known accountants in the country, and he says there's a problem. And he gets murdered eventually. Because it turns out that he has spotted the problem all right, and the problem is fraud. The problem is that you've got two divisions that seem to be doing about the same thing, and one of them is making money and one of them is losing money. And that sounds, well, it's a problem for the guy who's losing money. What should you do about it? No. It's a problem for the guy who's making money, because when the accountant actually works through the accounts, it becomes clear to him that he's making money by defrauding the U.S. government, which is his customer. That's the real explanation of the discrepancy. You can't do what you're claiming you do in a profit, basically, and the other guy is doing it honestly and is losing money, and this guy is doing it dishonestly and making money. So the accountant gets killed, and that's sort of central to the story. It's sort of a neat story, because in a certain sense, the accountant is the hero, and that's not a usual choice of hero. So if you have nothing else to do, I don't know if law school leaves you time for recreational fiction, or if your forms of recreation are watching football games or television or arguing with people on the internet, which is a lot of my recreation, but I would recommend Accounting for Murder as sort of a fun mystery. And you don't have to think too hard. It's not sort of the high-end stuff. All right, so finance. And finance, we talked about the theory of the firm. Ronald Coase, who becomes important for other reasons a little later on in the course, wrote an essay on the nature of the firm. One of the things he got the Nobel Prize for, but probably the less important of the two things. And that really, from my standpoint, starts with the question of why we have firms at all. That, you know, once you're really saturated in price theory, you say, we've got this solution to the coordination problem. How do we get people to cooperate? People produce stuff and sell it to each other, and then the price system coordinates them. And well, that's very interesting. So how come you have employees? How come the usual pattern? Why am I not here standing in a room which I have rented for an appropriate fee from the owners of the building, and I'm giving you a course in this subject for which you will pay me at the end of the semester a mutually agreed upon sum? Why isn't the university replaced by a marketplace in which everybody is a proprietor? That's one way of seeing the problem that Post was trying to answer. And of course, having started to answer that gets you into the sort of finer question, why is it that the law school is part of the university instead of the law school being a separate enterprise? It certainly could have been. Yet why is it the university, Santa Clara University, is in some sense an independent organization rather than, like Berkeley, a part of a much larger organization? Now, you could say it is part of a larger organization. It's called the Society of Jesus. And that would also be an interesting question. What is the function of the Jesuits? I just came across a reference by Orwell to the Jesuits. So that was interesting. He's talking about the Spanish Civil War, which he fought in on the losing side, and in which the Catholic Church on the whole was on the opposite side from his. And he says that according to something he's read, the total membership of the Jesuit order is about 20,000 people worldwide. And that if that's right, they must be the most effective human organization for its numbers that's ever existed. But as I say, the question is, the Kolsky question is, why are certain things done within a firm and certain things outside? And you could imagine that all the way from the question of why we have any firm with more than one person to the question of why the entire world isn't a single firm coordinated from the top, as it were, the sort of centrally planned Stalinist view of how to run the world. And Kolsky offers an interesting set of answers to this that you could sum up as there is one set of transaction costs that you get into when you try to run stuff by hierarchy, a different set when you try to run stuff by markets, and the trade-off between those determines where you draw the line. There's then the idea which the textbook attributes to Burl and Means, but which is an Adam Smith more than 100 years earlier, which is the problem of, in a joint stock company, how do you make the managers act in the stockholders' interest? And we're running out of time now, so I will continue this stuff. Incidentally, this PowerPoint show and the previous one are now up on the webpage as my 2011 PowerPoints, if you want to look at them. I think I'm completely up to date, I believe, on what's on the webpage at this instant, but not necessarily tomorrow. Completely up to date, not counting Roger.